Now, time for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, the campaign to legalise same-sex marriage in India, and tourists to the Czech Republic are given advice on how to deal with wolves. But first we go to Sudan. Instability in the country has unsettled surrounding nations after a week of fighting between groups loyal to rival generals seeking control of the country. Global leaders have called for peace between the two rival groups, the Sudanese army and a paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, with some going so far as to host mediation talks. Hundreds have died since the conflict began 8 days ago, while thousands have been injured. Amy Nirieda reports now from Nairobi in neighbouring Kenya.
With many countries surrounding Sudan already mired in their own internal conflicts, East Africa is on tenterhooks, watching for any developments which may impact their own interests in the country. Straddling the River Nile as well as bordering the Red Sea, Sahel region and Horn of Africa, Sudan's strategic location and agricultural wealth have attracted competition for external influence. It's also rich in rare minerals and other natural resources. With the region currently suffering from famine and drought, as well as an ongoing civil war in South Sudan, neighbouring countries are already bulging with asylum seekers. Sudan itself is home to over 1 million refugees. Humanitarian aid in the country has been paused, threatening the food security of millions, while four humanitarian workers are among the dead. The UN said it also cannot carry out its efforts to assist farmers in increasing agricultural output in a scheme aimed at more than doubling Sudan's annual wheat production, nor can it assist people in rebuilding their livelihoods while the fighting continues. Despite the revocation of aid and an attempted cessation, battles rage in the country's capital, Khartoum, and surrounding towns. World leaders have called for an end to the violence in a rare display of unity. Russia, China and the US have all condemned the clashes. Closer to home, Kenyan President William Ruto said he had spoken to the UN Secretary General and offered to host mediation talks. He didn't, however, commit to hosting any refugees fleeing the conflict. He said priority should be placed on allowing unrestricted access to humanitarian aid in the country. Kenya has in the past mediated conflict in Sudan. In 2005, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in Nairobi between Dr. John Garang of the Sudan People's Liberation Army and Sudan's then Vice President Ali Osman Taha, which led to the end of the Second Sudanese War. It remains to be seen whether history can repeat itself in the name of peace. Any instability in the region is a major concern for external heavyweights. Egypt has close ties with Sudan's military and considers it an ally against Ethiopia, with whom it has clashed over the use of the Nile River Basin's waters. Chad and South Sudan are closest to the conflict, with fears that the violence could spread across either border. A planned mission by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development heads of 8 member states last Monday was halted after an earlier ceasefire call collapsed. Conditions in Khartoum and surrounding areas are bleak. The death toll from Khartoum is also steadily rising. The capital is a key battleground in the fight for symbolic power. Many Sudanese homes have been affected by water and electricity cuts. Residents have been rationing foods, while others were forced to put a dent in their Ramadan stockpile. Instead of Eid celebrations, gunfights in the capital continued on Friday, dashing the hopes of a ceasefire to allow people to gather for the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Shelling was reported across Sudan, trapping thousands in their homes who were hoping to flee from battle areas to access food and water. The Sudanese attempts to transition to democracy have been a costly one, and the question remains as to whether any of it will be worth it. For World Report, this is Amy Nirieda in Nairobi, Kenya.
Next we go to India, where the country's Supreme Court has been hearing petitions seeking to legalise same-sex marriage. Same-sex couples in the LGBTQI community are hoping for a judgment in their favour, but the government and religious leaders strongly oppose same-sex unions, making for a lively and intense debate in the country. During the court hearings, the Irish poet and playwright Oscar Wilde was referenced in closing submissions. From India, Shalu Yadav reports.
An urban elitist concept is how the Indian government describes the calls to legalize same-sex marriages in India. This statement is insensitive and puts a lid on the reality of changing India, say those fighting for marital rights for all, regardless of sexual orientation. In a country of about 1.4 billion people, it is estimated that about 10% or 135 million people identify themselves as LGBTQI. And it's their rights at stake here. Homosexuality was decriminalized in India back in 2018 by the Supreme Court, which was a historic judgment as it overturned a British-era law under which gay sex was categorized as a punishable, unnatural offense. The ruling was described as a milestone in contemporary India. Hundreds of thousands of people from and beyond the community came out on the streets and danced their way into a more free and inclusive society. It paved the way for more and more people to come out of the closet. But even though they earned the right to love, they did not earn the same rights as heterosexual couples in the country, like being married, being legal parents to children, or the right to inheritance or even divorce. And it's simple things like getting a joint bank account or health insurance or owning a house together which cannot be done as a same-sex couple because their union is not recognized in Indian law. The Indian government has no plans to change that. Modi's government says that same-sex relations cannot be compared to the sacred Indian family concept of a husband, a wife, and children born out of that union. Some Indian politicians call it a Western concept. Adding to this reflection of India as a conservative country is resistance from religious bodies on all sides, be it Hindus or Muslims. A Muslim religious body, in fact, told the court that the concept of same-sex marriage will essentially attack the Indian family system. They say that if legalized, same-sex marriages will dilute the stable institution of marriage and bring in a free-floating system that would be harmful to the social order. Such is the dichotomy of the Indian society. On the one hand, we see a vast change in attitudes towards homosexuality. On the other hand, it seems the Indian society is just about okay for LGBTQI community to coexist until they raise a hand for equal legal rights. According to a Pew Research in 2020, about 37% of people in India agree that homosexuality should be accepted. And that is a huge increase from 15% in 2014, which was a time that discussions around homosexuality and their rights started to pick up pace in India. The arguments in the court offer a ringside view of how far India has come in its journey towards accepting LGBTQI rights. The Chief Justice of India, D.Y. Chandrachud, said that the state cannot discriminate against a person for his or her sexual orientation, which is innate to him or her, and over which he or she has no control. He called out the government for calling the petitions an urban elitist concept, saying that there's no data to suggest that at all. He even dared to push the boundary by saying that the notion of a man and a woman is not an absolute based on genitals. The Council for Petitioners said that the families of the community have by and large accepted them, and now they want their children to have a family too. They don't want them to be ostracized. Reference was also made to the great Irish poet Oscar Wilde by the petitioner's lawyer. He reminded the judges' panel that Oscar Wilde was a homosexual in that era when he was imprisoned for it. He read a tribute to the poet to close his arguments. And alien tears will fill for him pity's long broken urn. For his mourners will all be outcast men, and outcasts always mourn. But there's a huge section of the Indian society who wants to protect the status quo and the Indian culture, as they call it. Divided on the issue, is India on the cusp of legalizing same-sex marriages? As the country waits with a bated breath for a final judgment, it seems that same-sex marriage may not be a far-off idea after all. For World Report, this is Shalu Yadav.
Finally, we go to Prague and one animal that has made a return to Europe's forests in the last decade is the Canis lupus, otherwise known as the grey wolf. So much so that in some places, the authorities are issuing guidelines for what to do in the unlikely event that you do come across one. That includes in the Czech Republic, where there are now around 100 of the animals living in packs, mostly in the border areas. From Prague, Rob Cameron reports.
It's funny the type of things you start doing as you get older. Things your parents did that seemed excruciatingly boring when you were a teenager, but now in early middle age, provide a sense of comfort, fulfillment, calm. For me, these are, in no particular order, growing plants on my balcony, walking, and spending a weekend in the countryside. I was enjoying the latter two pursuits not so long ago when I had a bit of an unsettling experience, one common to all of us, I'm sure. We were staying in a rented cottage in the far east of the country, a heavily forested area up near the Polish border. I'd gone out to stretch my legs, feeding a middle-aged obsession to close my circle on the fitness app that counts my steps and calories every day. Deep in distraction, courtesy of Bluetooth headphones and a podcast, I suddenly became rudely aware of a large, furry creature loping over the misty fields. Within seconds, it was right in front of me, grey fur, teeth snapping, drool flying, barking furiously. Adrenaline coursed through my veins as I started whimpering, "Good boy," and tried simultaneously to walk backwards and stand completely still. For a second, my panicked imagination attempted to process the scene. A million images flickered in front of my eyes like on a projector. Could this somehow be a wolf? Well, here's the thing. It could. Wolves have now returned to that corner of the Czech countryside, a beautiful area of pine forests and sandstone cliffs that surround the city of Bromov, home to a medieval monastery and a brewery. There's a pack of some 18 wolves, a delegation from the 2,000-strong Carpathian population that has gradually emigrated from neighbouring Poland and Slovakia. But the question was, do wolves bark? Or attack humans walking in fields at random? The rational part of my brain kicked in. Probably not. Indeed, it wasn't a wolf. Within seconds, the animal's breathless owner emerged from the gloom, apologising profusely and grabbing her dog by the scruff of the neck. I waved off her apology and went on my way, shaking slightly and laughing nervously to no one in particular. Encounters with wolves are, of course, famously rare, even in a country which now has perhaps 100 of the animals, mostly living in border areas. Us humans are mostly terrified of them, as evidenced by thousands of years of folk tales, and they're mostly terrified of us, understandably because we've spent centuries shooting at them. But perhaps that's beginning to change. Wolves are now a protected species. Groups that monitor returning wolf populations say the animals are becoming less scared of humans, and more humans are reporting encounters with wolves. This has led Czech experts to issue guidance to tourists and locals in areas with wolf populations. Don't approach the animals, and definitely don't attempt to feed them with snacks from your backpack. Keep your dog on a leash. A contest between a wild animal and the pet descended from it will always see the wild animal emerge victorious, and the consequences can be fatal for the pet. And finally, always leave it with an escape route. Part of me was disappointed my own encounter was with a German shepherd rather than Canis lupus, though the trips to the countryside have become more common, and who knows, there's always next time. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.